the choice of room was not mine. I did not know. But look, it's nice, it's pleasant. There are nice tables for those who have tables. I guess the answer just is that fewer people have to sign up for the next course. That's really right. No, I think this is just a today thing. I don't think this is a long-term
just today.
Situation.
Somebody asked that you mention that if they're in away, that they can get the classes online.
I mean,
you've mentioned it.
Yeah, well, everyone knows they get their follow-up email.
If somebody asked it, you knew.
Okay. I will note, because I was asked to note it, but I think hopefully you all have been receiving the emails each week following up from the class, so you know you can catch the audios when you miss a class. Although this is the last one in this series. I will be sending out, God willing, next week a flyer with registration information for the February series for those who will be around in February, or those who want to, be on the email list for it and get the links for the classes online. It'll be about ethical policing, and it should be a lot of fun. I also want to make sure that people have seen this and have the opportunity to sign up for it. There are flyers that were going around. There are more flyers actually over here. I'm just going to send them around. If you want it, take it. If you don't want it, just pass it around. But this is an all-day program on December 25th. It is 9 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Enough time left after that you can go home and light the menorah that evening. It is, you can just come for half an hour. You can come for the entire day. You could come for lunch. You do. Please do sign up, though, if you're coming for lunch. And it's on 13 different stories of failure from Tanakh. And no, it's not meant to depress people, but it's meant because we learn from failure, we learn from mistakes, and we're going to look at these different stories. Plus, during lunch, there's a panel discussion on the whole concept of associating failure with people who are in Tanakh, which is a question in its own right. We'll have to talk more about that, obviously, at the panel. But I hope to see many of you there. If you're in Florida, it will be on Facebook Live, so you could tune in that way. Please, if you could silence your phones, that would be great, especially with everybody sitting so close together. And finally, as I mentioned in my email and as was requested at the end of last class, I'm going to try to finish this within the hour. But in the event that we don't finish it within the hour and need to stay an extra few minutes, those who can stay, great. Those who can't stay, I am not at all offended or insulted. But I'm going to try to fit it all in within our time frame. We have two topics to talk about. One is the issue of whether those who pass away are aware of what's going on in this world as Judaism sees it. And the other is Priyat HaMeitim, the resurrection of the dead. So I brought you a source to start with. It's a passage from the Talmud in Brachot. It's a great story, and I only brought you the first part of the story. It's actually longer than what you see on the sheet. Story goes this way. A pious person gave a dinar to a pauper on the eve of Rosh Hashanah in a time of famine. So they didn't have a lot of money. Dinar is a significant amount. It's Erev Rosh Hashanah, the day before Rosh Hashanah, and he says, you know what, I'm going to give this away to some needy person. His wife quarreled with him. She wasn't so happy. He went and slept in a cemetery. So Rosh Hashanah night, he's kicked out of the house. Right? Everyone else having their rounds of honey or whatever it is, she kicks him out. And he goes to sleep in a cemetery. Look, it's quiet. Or it's supposed to be quiet. It's actually not quiet. Look what happens in the story. He hears two spirits speaking to each other. One of them said to her friend, my friend, let's go travel the world and listen behind the curtain to learn what punishment is coming to this world. This is Rosh Hashanah. It is the day of judgment. Let's hear what God is planning. And the curtain, the image in Hebrew is me'achorei ha'pargod. It's that there is some kind of sort of closed-off area up there, the inner circle of God, and that's where God is determining what's going to happen this year. Let's go eavesdrop. Apparently you can. I don't know. Her friend replied, I can't. for I am buried in a mat of reeds. But you go and tell me what you hear. Something is wrong with the way that she is buried. What that is a great topic for another time. We could do a series on burial and all that, but I think that would be really depressing. But you go and you tell me what you hear. She went, traveled, and returned. Her friend said, my friend, what did you hear from behind the curtain? She told her, I heard that anyone who plants in the first rains, hail will strike him. So there is a series of rains in Israel. Israel just got rain the end of last week after a long wait. But there is supposed to be a set of rains, and another set, and then another set. And if you plant with the first rain, it's not going to be good. There's going to be hail. So the pious person who had given the tzedakah, given the charity, went and planted in the second rains. The entire world's produce was struck. His was not struck. Right? I imagine that he couldn't really go tell people what he had heard. Like, he's going to go walking around in the marketplace and telling people, no, don't plant, don't plant. I was sleeping in the cemetery and I heard the spirits. Don't plant. But this is what he does. And as the story plays out, this works again a second year. The next year, he again goes to sleep in the cemetery. It worked last year. And he overhears this time that people should plant early. If you plant late, you're going to have a problem. So he plants early and again does very well. And then he goes back the third year. And the third year, he hears one spirit say to the other, let's go. And the other one says, no, we're being eavesdropped. Someone's listening to what we're saying. So the implication here is that those who have passed away are aware of what's going to happen here, what is in fact happening here, that they have some level of interest in what's going on here. And the question I want to ask is this meant for real? Is that really what Judaism imagines, that people who have passed away have nothing better to do with their time then look at how the economy is going to do, here on Earth. So that's a question that I'd like to look at the outset. The question of their awareness of this world, their focus on this world. That's what I want to go to first. So the truth of the matter is that when you go back to biblical sources, it is unclear. It's really unclear. It comes up all the time in Jewish popular culture. Right? How many times have you been at a wedding and you heard them say under the chuppah, we are so glad that this grandparent is here and this grandparent is here and the other ones are looking down from the heavens and they're getting nachas and so on. It's a standard concept. The idea of going to a grave, which we've talked about in previous sessions, and appealing to whoever is buried there to pray on behalf of the living, to intercede with God on behalf of of their descendants, on behalf of their students, whoever. From some of the texts that we brought in previous weeks, it sounds like the dead are aware. Right? We had the story from Endor, where Shaul goes to speak with Shmuel, with Samuel. Right, the incident of the Ob in Endor. We also had the prohibition against seeking the dead, trying to have some kind of a dialogue with them. And we have verses that support it. Take a look, please, at source number 2. This actually is a set of 2 verses in which the second one seems to contradict the first one. This is Job speaking. And this text is an unclear text in context, but look at what it says. He's describing a person's fate. His children will be honored, and he will not know. They will be in pain. He will not understand. Only his own flesh will feel pain, and his spirit will grieve for himself. Now, what is this talking about? So some take it as referring to someone who has passed away, saying that the person who has passed away is not aware of what happens with his children, is not aware of the good or the bad, but is aware of his own experience, is aware of the deterioration of the flesh. So some look at this and say, that means the body, somehow or other, is communicating with the soul and the person is aware. But on the other hand, there's a lack of awareness of what's going on with the with his children. It's really unclear. But the verses get used both ways. People can take this passage and take it one way, and they can take this passage and take it the other. A classic one is source number three, from Ecclesiastes. For the living know they will die, and the dead know nothing. Suggesting that there is no awareness at all. Out of this mix, the Talmud seems to be biased towards saying that the dead are aware. It's a debate, Talmudically, because the biblical evidence really goes both ways. But the Talmud ends up with an indication that, yes, people are aware, even after they pass on, of what is going on here. And if you take a look at source number four, you find a critical passage in this regard. It is part of the same passage from which I drew source number one. The Talmud here begins its discussion with something else, and let me give you the context for it. This is from the volume of Talmud called Brachot, and much of the volume called Brachot is actually about the mitzvah of reciting Shema. We have a mitzvah to recite Shema every morning and every evening, but this particular passage is talking about when one might be exempt from the mitzvah of reciting Shema, and specifically if one is taking care of a body that is awaiting burial. If someone is engaged in the mitzvah of preparing somebody for burial, then they are exempt from reciting Shema. And that's where this passage begins, and it's talking about something which is called in Hebrew, Shmirah. What is Shmirah?
Guarding.
Guarding, and in this context, it is specifically what?
Guarding
the body. Correct. Guarding the body. We haven't practiced that. We do not leave someone alone, someone who has passed away. There are different origins for this. One origin that is suggested for it is simply practical. Unfortunately, historically, you didn't have the types of setups that exist now in funeral homes or in a hospital morgue, and bodies were vulnerable, and therefore there was a need to keep somebody with the body to prevent harm. And then also, there is the idea, which is relevant in our discussion, that the person who has passed away is actually aware of goings-on around the body, and they shouldn't feel abandoned. Like, they passed away, and now everybody left them and went home, and they're stuck on their own. And so they should have somebody present with them. That's the idea of Shmirah. Yeah.
Isn't there a body of opinion that says that part of the nefesh stays with the body until...
Yes, absolutely.
So that
there
would be the part that would be potentially aware.
Exactly. That light goes on when you say something.
It's off when
a bright light.
Right there,
bright
light.
So, what he had said was, there is an idea, which connects directly to this, that some aspect of the neshama, we've talked about the neshama in different parts, nefesh, ruach, neshama, so some part of the soul actually stays with the body, and that's this idea. So take a look at source number four, where the Talmud begins by saying, one who guards a dead body, even if it is not his responsibility, meaning it's not an immediate relative, it's not somebody he has a personal connection with, or she, is exempt from Shema, as well as the Amidah, Shmoneh Esrei, and Tefillin and all biblical mitzvot. While engaged in doing this, they're exempt from anything that would take them away from it. And the continuation of the discussion is about how one takes care of a body. One who transports bones may not put them in a sack or on a donkey and ride on them. That would disgrace them. You have to be careful. You have to treat them with respect. Anyone who sees a dead body and does not escort it violates the following verse from Proverbs. One who mocks a pauper blasphemes against his creator. Right? The Loeg Larash, Chereif Oseyu. If you mock somebody who is poor, you should recognize that it's also blaspheming against God. How dare you mock somebody who is vulnerable? And the same thing is true regarding the dead body. The body should be escorted. People should participate. And if he escorts him, what is his reward? What's the reward for what is essentially going to a funeral? Rav Asi said, regarding him, the text says, one who is a creditor of God who aids the indigent. You are considered to be a creditor of God if you help a needy person. You think you're just helping the needy person, but you're actually, so to speak, lending your money to God. and one who honors him, who aids the needy. Whatever you're doing on behalf of the vulnerable, whatever you're doing on behalf of the needy, is considered an act for God as well. And what we're doing here is saying the person who passed away, who cannot do things for themselves, is in that position of being in need, and you are effectively assisting God by taking care of this person. You may have seen the practice that some have, when a funeral isn't entirely in the cemetery, but instead it starts out at a synagogue or at a funeral home. So obviously there's the line traveling behind the hearse, but those who aren't going to the cemetery will wait for the hearse to start to move and then walk behind the hearse. This is part of that practice of escorting the body, trying to show some level of respect. What the Talmud here is saying is that the person who passed away is actually aware, and therefore would be disrespectful not to escort them. I'm just going to get through the source first, and then I'll take questions. Rabbi Chiya and Rabbi Yonatan were in discussion. They're sitting in, or standing, they're talking about Torah. They walked in a cemetery. And Rabbi Yonatan's tzitzit were out, right? Tzitzit, the strings, the fringes that are a mitzvah, they're out. Rabbi Chiya said to him, pick it up. You should tuck them in. Don't have them hanging out. Lest they say, the dead are going to say, tomorrow he's going to come to us and now he mocks us. Meaning, we can't fulfill the mitzvah, so you're mocking us by putting this mitzvah on display as you walk through the cemetery. Rabbi Yonatan replied, do they know that much? He quotes you the verse that we saw in source number 3, the dead know nothing. To which Rabbi Chiya responded, if you have read, you haven't read twice. If you read twice, you haven't read three times. And if you have read three times, they still haven't explained it to you. Meaning, you don't know what you're reading. For the living know they will die. The first half of that sentence, that refers to the righteous, who are called living even in death. And the dead know nothing are the wicked, who are called dead even in life. So he says, the verse isn't telling you that that those who have passed away know nothing. Those who are righteous know, whether they're here or beyond, and those who aren't righteous don't know anything even when they are here. That's his his statement. Yes, it's an insult to some, it's a compliment to others, but his point is to say, don't make me proofs from that verse. We consider them to be aware. Now, you could make the argument that this isn't literal. You could make the argument that the point here is actually just sensitivity. Even though they are not aware, it's right for me to be thinking about others and to be sensitive to the fact that those who are buried are not fulfilling mitzvot, and therefore I should be a little bit more modest about what I am doing and not put it out on display. Right? You're familiar with the practice of covering the challah Friday night during Kiddush, right? Yeah. So why is that done? So there are actually two. Yeah, there are a lot of different answers there. Or the same answer, multiple voices. There are actually two origins that are offered. The technical origin for three origins. Fine. One element of it is that when you have the two loaves of bread at a Shabbat meal, it's supposed to echo the man. Right, the manna that fell in the wilderness, and we got a double portion to prepare for Shabbat, so we have two loaves, and as the Torah describes it, the man was covered with a layer of dew. It had a layer below it and a layer above it in order to shield it from the dirt and elements and so on, so therefore you have a plate below it, and you have a cover on top of it. That's one. Second, on a technical level, is because if I have a choice between making a blessing on bread or a blessing on wine, from purely technical perspective, I'm supposed to make the blessing on the bread first. So you cover it, it's out of sight, so to speak, and then you make the blessing on the wine. However, the explanation that they teach in the schools is a third and different idea, and that's one that I heard people saying, which is, you don't want to embarrass the challah. Right, the challah is sitting there, and I'm making a blessing on the wine. That's not nice. So cover it up so it shouldn't see. Bread not aware of anything. Right?
It's also mentioned before on Shefar Milim.
That was the second reason that I gave. But the point for our purpose is it can be about sensitivity, even though the bread is not aware of anything, and therefore the argument can be made that when you're walking in the cemetery, tuck in the tzitzit, don't put the mitzvah on display, it's about your sensitivity, it's not about what they're aware of. But that's not the way that's being taken here in the Talmud. It's being taken as they are aware, it is considered to be mocking them, so don't do it. And the last paragraph, the number four, the sons of Rabbi Chiya traveled among the villages. They went out on the road. Their learning became difficult for them. They labored in pain to remember it. One of them said to the other, "Does our father, who had passed away, know of this pain?" And the other said, "How would he know?" And he quotes you part of what we saw in source number two, the verse from Job that says, "His sons will be honored and he will not know. He doesn't know what's going on with us." And the other replied, "Doesn't he know? Look at the next verse. His flesh will pain him, his soul will mourn for itself." Suggests that there is some awareness of something in this world. We are also his flesh, therefore he should be aware of what is happening with us. So what you get here is a debate, in fact, among the sages. They don't know. The biblical verses are not clear about whether the dead know. And the Talmud itself has a debate about whether they know or do not know. Okay. One more source on this that I bring because it's important for this discussion, but also because it leads into a practice that, again, I think many people are familiar with, the practice of having a minyan in a shiva house. Right? The practice, why is it that there are minyanim in a shiva house? Why is there davening going on in a shiva house?
It's a congregation.
So that's what a lot of people think, that the mourner needs to be able to say Kaddish, and therefore there's a minyan for that sake. So what if somebody passes away and they don't have anyone who's going to say Kaddish for them? Is there a reason to have davening in the Sheva house? Sorry? So take a look at source number five. Passage also from the Talmud. Rav Chisda said, "A person's soul mourns for himself for 7 days. As it is written, his soul will be a veil for himself. It is also written, he performed for his father a 7-day evil." That second verse, "he performed for his father a 7-day evil," is after Jacob dies. So Joseph observes a 7-day period of mourning. That's one of the origins for the fact that we have a 7-day Shiva period. But the idea that the soul is itself grieving leads to the next line. Rav Yehuda said, "If there are no people to be comforted after a mourner's death," okay, person passed away, and there are no relatives around, "then 10 men go sit in his place. A minion should go sit in the Shiva house. There was such a case in Rabbi Yehuda's neighborhood, and each day Rabbi Yehuda brought a group of 10, and they sat in his place. After 7 days, the deceased appeared in a dream of Rabbi Yehuda and said to him, 'May your mind rest, for you caused rest for my mind.'" So the idea, again, of not abandoning them, and the idea that they have some kind of an awareness, also, what I'm sure you've heard at some point, the idea that they have an awareness in the Shiva house, they're actually, to some extent, present and know what's going on, are all seen in this Talmudic passage. Rabbi Abba said, "The deceased knows all that is said in its presence until the grave is closed," and that actually leads to a whole other discussion, Talmudically, about what is appropriate to discuss. When someone has passed away, you're going to be there in the room. What's appropriate conversation? So, the idea that those who have passed away are aware of what's going on, aware in the Shiva house and aware in general, leads to actually certain Jewish practices, some of which we've already mentioned. One, having the tzitzit tucked in the cemetery rather than having them hanging out is one example. Care in what we talk about around them is another. Shmirah, guarding the body, the Shiva minyanim, and also the issue of what's called Nivul Hamet. Nivul Hamet means what? Anybody know? It's essentially disgracing the body of somebody who has passed away. There's a lot of discussion in Responsa about the question of organ donation and when is it appropriate to give, when is it not appropriate to give, and that's not our discussion right now. That's a much, much bigger issue. But one of the factors that is considered is the question of maybe what you're doing to the body is degrading to the body. The balance against it is no, this person would want their body used in order to save someone. I'm not, going through the entire debate right now. But I want to show you an example of this in source number six. The following what's happened in B'nai Brak. A male sold his father's property and later died. So the male had some kind of property that he had inherited from his father, and then he sold it off. But family members, after the death, objected. that he had been a minor at the time of his death. In other words, this fellow who sold it off, they said, wasn't an adult, and therefore was not able to sell it. And therefore the property is still in the estate, and therefore they want to inherit it. But how are you going to prove whether he was an adult or whether he was a minor? So they didn't have the kind of birth records that you would work with today. The way you would do it is inspect the body for signs of physical maturity. That would be the examination. So they asked Rabbi Akiva about examining the body. Rabbi Akiva said no. And he gave two reasons for saying no. He said, first of all, it would be degrading to the body to exhume him for this purpose. And then second, he said, in any case, you're not getting a real inspection. You can't tell that you're going to dig up the body and be able to tell whether this person was, you know, physically mature or not. And therefore, he rejects it. My point is, this issue of exhuming a body is also part, and the organ donation discussion separately, are, you know, surround. One of the issues is the issue of potentially degrading the body. Diane.
Whose body did they want to dig up? The kid or the father?
The kid. The kid who had sold it off. Right. Okay. So what we have then, in terms of our first issue here, the question of whether the whether people are aware afterwards is a firm maybe. They, we have a very firm maybe, I think. But with a bias, I think, in the sources, certainly the ones I brought you, but I believe they are representative, a bias towards saying that there is, in fact, an awareness. It isn't only about be sensitive around them because it's good for you to be sensitive. It's also about them having some kind of an awareness of what is going on. The neshama, the soul, not being bounded, is able to be aware and, in fact, has some level of interest. Clear? And then Jack, yeah.
So you mentioned the Shema and then you mentioned body, and that's what confuses me through all those texts that you brought up. What are we talking? Are we talking about the body? Are we talking about the
Neshama, the soul?
Only the soul.
Yes.
Not the body.
Correct.
When you say awareness and whatever, it's
it means
about
soul.
The soul.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
The Neshama, assuming there is a Neshama that has an awareness, it must be aware enough to be able to travel in a metaphysical sense, if not in any other sense, because people sit Shiva in different places. I mean, unless you're sitting Shiva in exactly the spot where the person died, which doesn't usually happen, if you expect the neshama to be there when you're sitting Shiva, it has to have the ability to travel somehow.
Correct. And the idea of travel is not troublesome at all if you're dealing with something that's a non-physical entity. It's a lot easier to get a flight than you know, take up space. But yes, it's a very interesting question in its own right, and one that I started looking into with this series and decided I wasn't going to go into it because it's very confusing stuff and largely mystical. But the question of what is the relationship of the soul to space ever? We say it inhabits the body, right? It's present around by someone's alive. But why should it be? Once it has no physical dimensions, right? Unless you talk about this issue of the nefesh being quasi-physical, which I mentioned in the first week. But it's very odd, and there isn't a lot of textual basis. I don't feel like it's very well anchored in text, and that's why I'm sort of staying away from it, because I don't think there's anything authoritative that I could really present on it as much as just, philosophy. Yes? Judith.
It seems that there's another way of confirming the presence of the soul, because a lot of attention is paid while there is this transition, so to speak, from, And then after a period of time, there's not so much focus on, other than the art side kind of thing. So, in my mind, it gives credence to the presence of the soul by the traditional ways of dealing with just died.
So, in other words, the idea would be that there's intense involvement by the mourners and by the relatives and so forth around that time because the soul is considered to be present then.
Yes.
You could read it, though, as something different, right? You could read it as it's for their sake that there's more intense involvement, and it's for their sake that there's less of an involvement going forward. You could really argue it either way, I think. I'm going to take one more question, and then we're going to go further to talk reincarnation, but resurrection, definitely. Yes?
Is there any kind of a writing about where a Shiva should take place? Is it any relation to where the person passed away.
Right. So I was going to mention that in response to Jack, and then forgot to when he went on with the other piece. It was more interesting. But yes, there's a definite preference for observing Shiva where the person last lived. That is a definite preference. Recognizing that is often not a realistic possibility for all sorts of reasons. But yes, that is a preference. Okay, so let's talk about Triyat HaMetim, the ultimate resurrection of the dead. So this is not the same thing as reincarnation. We dealt with reincarnation. We got confused by that already last week. This week we have to get confused by resurrection of the dead. So as we discussed when we talked about Gan Eden and Gehenna, the Garden of Eden and Hell, and when we talked about the alternate endings of Limbo and Divus and reincarnation and so forth, here too, we have significant biblical evidence that there is Triyat HaMetim, that there is an ultimate resurrection of the dead. But we don't have clear description of what exactly is going to happen. More description here than of Gan Eden and Gehinnom. But it's still unclear, and the rabbis use logic to try to chart a path that they feel will be consistent with the biblical text. So what we're going to do is go through the biblical text first, and then see what the rabbis have done with it. The questions that we have to be asking are, the first question we have to ask is, when we're looking for the ultimate resurrection of the dead in biblical text, what exactly is it that we're looking for? What are we trying to find? And the answer is two elements. Number one, the idea of the dead coming back to life. But number two, as we'll see in the text, very closely linked to it, is the idea of judgment and reward and punishment, some ultimate judgment day, which, the Christians have trademarked and now it's theirs. But it started with us. But some kind of day of judgment associated with that resurrection of the dead. So if you take a look at source number 7, I'm going to show you biblical verses, some of which you may look at and say, oh yeah, that speaks about it. Some of which you will look at and say, I don't understand what they think they're seeing here. And some of it somewhere in between. But these verses that I'm about to bring are verses that are brought in the Talmud as evidence of a belief in an ultimate resurrection of the dead. So take a look at source number 7. God is speaking in this first line to Moshe, to Moses. And he says, I have established my covenant with the patriarchs to give them the land of Canaan. That is supposed to be evidence of an ultimate resurrection of the dead. I have established my covenant with the patriarchs to give them the land of Canaan. Why is that proof? Because they're dead. By the time God is speaking to Moses, and he says, I'm going to give them the land of Canaan. The only way they're getting the land of Canaan is if they come back.
The dead may be the people.
No, but they are. But
them may be the people.
No, because he says, I made my covenant with them to give them the land.
And their seeds.
No, because the verse doesn't say that. It says to give them. It doesn't say to give their descendants. It says to give it to them. Similarly, take a look at the next line, also in number 7, where God promises that your days, the days of your descendants, will be many upon the land which God has sworn to your ancestors to give to them. Now, I think it's clear that you don't have to read this as a statement that they're going to come back to get the land. You could just as easily read it as God is giving it to them because it's their nation that is receiving it. But the literal text is read that way. But if you didn't like those as a source, you really won't like number 8. Number 8, I only brought you the Hebrew because the way to read this in terms of evidence for resurrection it requires that you violate all the rules of grammar and reading of text. I'll explain what I mean. The Hebrew readers will like this. The English readers may not catch it, but that's okay. All the other ones are all in English. God is speaking to Moshe, to Moses, before his death. And God says to him, Hincha shochevim avotecha. I'm reading the text the way you would normally read it, with the rules of grammar in Hebrew, with the notes and all that. Hincha shochevim avotecha. He says to Moshe, you will lie with your ancestors. V'kam ha'am hazeh v'zanah harei Eloheinu echar ha'aretz. And this nation will rise and they will stray after the foreign. gods of the land. So all it's saying to Moshe is, you should be a little depressed because you're going to pass on and then the people are going to go astray after idolatry. However, says the Talmud, you could read it as, you will lie with your ancestors and you will rise.
Because there are no
comments. Because there are no, there is no notation in the biblical text. The only problem is what do you do with the rest of the sentence? This nation and will stray after. It's not a grammatical read. So that's the problem. The truck pauses there. That's not the Anavosef. The way to read, if you're reading it with the truck with the notes, it would be in a pause. Vikam has a flesha, and then the next part goes, it's like the word Vikam is sort of stuck in the middle and could be read with the first part, could be read with the second part, but logically it's much more with the second part. So fine. What you see here are verses which, if I had these in a vacuum, I would say, you've got to do better than that to convince me that Judaism believes in an ultimate resurrection of the dead. Take a look at the next one, which I bring you here in number 9, which is similar. When Moses blesses the tribes, he says, may Reuven live and not die, which is oddly redundant. We noted this verse also when we talked about reincarnation. And there it was used by pro-reincarnation to say it means he should live and he should not have to die a second time. Well, those who argue that it demonstrates belief in resurrection of the dead say may he live in this world and not die in the next world, meaning he should be resurrected. And again, you look at that and think, is that really the best we can do? Another type of evidence is seen in source number 10. God speaking to Moses, there's a similar verse in Hannah's song in the book of Shmuel, the book of Samuel. God says, I will kill and I will bring to life. I have struck and I will heal. And when you look at it, the order is strange. I will kill and I will bring to life. Ani amid v'achayeh is the opposite, right? It should be, I will bring to life and I will also put to death. It's backward. So that leads some to suggest it's not backward. God will put to death, and then God will bring people back to life. And so that is brought as well as evidence. These verses, honestly, I don't find, speaking personally, someone asked me in an email whether I'll give my opinion on any of this. My opinion is relatively straightforward. I believe in the Garden of Eden and Gehenna, all the things that we discussed. The limbo thing, the Dybbuk thing, not so sold. The reincarnation thing, not so sold. Resurrection of the dead, I think, is basic to Judaism. But these verses aren't going to really be what convinces us that it's there. The verses that speak much more powerfully and much more clearly about it are found in the prophets. The most obvious of them is source number 11 in the book of Daniel. This is the last chapter of the book of Daniel. And what Daniel is told is the following, number 11. And at that time, this future time that he's discussing, Michael, the great officer who stands over your countrymen, the idea is that there are angels in the heavens, Malachim, who represent each nation. Michael is our representative. He will stand. There will be a time of trouble such as never occurred from the time the nation came into existence until that time. At that time, all from your nation who are inscribed in the book shall escape. And the book suggests the book of life, like that image that we've talked about before. And many of those who sleep in the dirt will awaken, these for eternal life, these for humiliation and eternal shame. So this links coming back and an ultimate judgment. And those who have insight will shine like the radiance of the heavens, and those who lead the masses to righteousness will be like the stars forever. And then the last verse in Daniel, and you go to the end, you shall rest, and you shall rise for your lot at the end of days. This, by the way, makes it into the funeral liturgy, as does the rise for your lot at the end of days. But also, the line will shine like the radiance of the heavens makes it into the Kel Malay prayer, right? Kizara Kiyam Azirim, that's that line, shine like the radiance of the heavens. But the image here is decidedly one of the dead coming back to life and there being some kind of day of judgment. That's the clearest biblical reference. With that as context, I'll show you a few others. Take a look at source number 12, verse from Isaiah. Look at this prediction. This is from the JPS translation. I got lazy and said I have too many verses to translate, so I'm just going to pull this from there. I apologize because it means some of the words are not really English. The Lord of hosts will make on this mount for all the peoples a banquet of rich viands. Viands in this case means rich meats. Yeah. Rich meats.
French.
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 It's French.
Okay, it's not English. And I feel good. I did not go to school here, and even had I gone to school in Ontario, I still wouldn't know French. But if someone doesn't tell me how you pronounce it in French, I'll do my best.
Lyon.
Okay. A banquet of choice wines, a rich viand.
Right?
Seasoned with marrow.
Sounds delicious.
Choice wines, well refined.
We're getting hungry.
So there's a big banquet coming. And he will destroy on this mount the shroud that is drawn over the faces of all the peoples and the covering that is spread over all the nations. He will destroy death forever. And that's a line that gets quoted also in Shiva houses and in funeral liturgy. Bila hamavet lanesach. My Lord God will wipe the tears away from all faces, will put an end to the reproach of his people over all the earth, for it is the Lord who has spoken. There are different ways to translate these lines, but the JPS is offering you a fairly safe read of the sentences, and what he is predicting here is an ultimate day on which there is an end to death, and there is some kind of great big feast as well. If you take a look at source number 13, you will see as well more to the same point. Oh, let your dead revive, let corpses arise. Awake and shout for joy, you who dwell in the dust. Your dew is like the dew on fresh growth. You make the land of these shades come to life. Go, my people, enter your chambers, lock your doors behind you, hide but a little moment until the indignation passes. Meaning, there's going to be something bad coming before this, and at that point, take shelter. For lo, the Lord shall come forth before, from his place to punish the dwellers of the earth for their iniquity, and the earth shall disclose its bloodshed and shall no longer conceal its slain. At that point, all of those who have been made to suffer are going to have their death and their suffering avenged. So these verses give a sense of, at some point, the dead again coming back to life, and there being some kind of judgment. Here, I'm going to just speed through a couple of things quickly, just because they're here. I want it to be complete, but I don't want to spend a lot of time on them. Number 14 is a passage from Psalms that is brought to support this as well, and it's about, again, the order of death and life. Look at its description of what God does. He's talking to God. You hide your face, they are confused. You gather in their breath, people's breath, they expire, they return to their dust. You send forth your breath, they are created, and you renew the face of the earth. Suggesting again this cycle of death, and then new life. Sources 15, 16, and 17. 15, 16, 17? Yeah, sources 15, 16, and 17 I brought just for fun. These are not, in Jewish tradition, considered sources for resurrection of the dead. In Christian tradition, they are seen as sources for the resurrection of the dead. So they're our verses, but they get used in different ways. So if you take a look at number 15, this one is always fun. The second half of 15, where Hosea, the prophet, during the first temple, says, He, God, will revitalize us from 2 days. On the third day, He will raise us up and we will live. They like
wow,
that.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah.
Christian.
I mean, they took the line. It's not like it's
so
a surprise. When you read a text and you build your legend around it, then of course the text seems to predict it. It's not like rocket science creating a religion. If you take a look at number 16, they like this one as well. A prediction from the prophet Joel. Then I will pour out my spirit upon all flesh. Your sons and daughters will prophesy. Your elders will dream dreams. Your youths will see visions. This is not an LSD thing. This is something different. Also upon the male and female servants at that time, I will pour out my spirit. I will place signs in the heavens and the earth, blood, fire, and pillars of smoke, which, yes, gets incorporated into the Haggadah on Pesach. for reasons beyond the scope of this right now. And then number 17 as well, a passage from Job, is used also by the church as evidence for resurrection. But all of the verses that I brought, right, basically fit into one of two categories. Either a category of, I already believe in resurrection, and therefore I'm going to see this as evidence, like God promised it to the ancestors to give them the land. So once I already have a concept of resurrection, that makes sense. They're actually getting the land. And then the other, which is the verses from Isaiah, the verses from Daniel, which speak about an explicit idea of the end of death, an idea of the dead coming back to life, of being some kind of judgment, of being some big feast with Fion. But there is a third kind of verse which can't be ignored. And that is the kind of verse which actually seems to say, no, there's no such thing. I brought you a passage from Job. These verses that seem to say there is no resurrection generally come from either the book of Job or the book of Ecclesiastes. Take a look at number 18. This passage says, it's contrasting trees and people. There is hope for a tree. If it is cut down, it will renew itself. Its shoots will not cease. If its roots are old in the earth and its stump dies in the ground, at the scent of water it will bud and produce branches like a sapling. But mortals languish and die. Man expires. Where is he? Seems to indicate a lack of belief, certainly in a resurrection of the dead. The tree gets to have another cycle. The human being does not. It would even be read as questioning the whole concept of life after death. It sounds like the person's gone and case closed.
That's not a good metaphor because that's a physical manifestation of real life.
Yeah, it's the physical.
The physical but in the resurrection, maybe it is physical. We have to talk about that. I'm going to come back to that. But you're right. It would only be against the physical. It's a good point. But I think there are two notes that you have to be cognizant of here. Number one, both the book of Job and the book of Ecclesiastes are deliberately full of contradiction and mixed messages. They are books of debate. They're what's called usually wisdom literature, in which they go around and around. Ecclesiastes is full of internal contradictions because it's someone searching for wisdom and trying different ideas, and then you try an idea, and then you defeat the idea. You try another idea, and you defeat the idea, going around and around through the book. Makes it a very hard book to read. The book of Job, also, it's debate. Job is visited by three former friends, and they spend the book yelling at him, and he yells at them, and they have fun that way. Basically, from chapter 2, chapter 3, all the way until you're in the 30s already, and then you have a fourth person who comes in, and he yells at everybody. Elihu. And then God comes in, and he tells them, no, you've all got it wrong, but that's okay. Except for Job. But my point is that you can't bring evidence of what this is what the Bible believes from books which are willing to entertain ideas and throw out ideas and entertain ideas and throw out ideas. You never know what they actually think until you get to the end. That's number one. Number two, each text does have potential resolutions. So as an example, Rabbi Sadia Gaon, who I mentioned already last week, says in source number 19, I looked for something that might deny the resurrection of the dead in this world. I found doubts which those who deny this might depend on. I have found a basis, he says, to question the resurrection. I saw fit to cite them here and defeat them. And he says, I'm going to go through all the texts one by one. And he quotes the verse that we had here, the passage that we had here. Among them is the passage in Job, a man lies and will not rise, and the like. I examined all of this well. I did not find any of them that meant that the Creator said he will not resurrect the dead. Rather, these say a person cannot rise from the grave independently after he descends there. He cannot shake off the dust and return home. You can't do it yourself. That which is found in these statements is the word of people who plead before their Creator, ask him to have mercy upon them. We can't do this ourselves. It's not a statement of resurrection never takes place. That's the way he reads it. My point is to show you that rabbis have looked at this and said, well, there are multiple ways to read the verses. Are we clear or am I going too fast with this?
No.
You can say so.
We're not shy.
Some of you are not shy. Some people are. So what we have right now, again, are biblical verses that can be used to support it, biblical verses that say it explicitly, and some biblical verses that seem to challenge the idea. Although, as long as they're in Ecclesiastes or Job, you have to question, is this really what the book believes, or is this simply what's called in Aramaic, in Talmud study, a havamina, something that they start with, let's look at this, is it real, is it not real, and ultimately can be accepted or rejected in the discussion. When you get to the rabbis, they take it as an absolute given that the dead are going to come back to life, and it's even considered to be unquestionable. Take a look at source number 20. This is from a Mishnah. Mishnah is the core work of Jewish law. When the Jewish verbal tradition and explanation of the biblical text is written down, the first stop, so to speak, is Mishnah, and then Gemara after it. So this Mishnah here is written down at some point between, call it the beginning of the Common Era and the year 200. Somewhere in that span, this is recorded. And the following people do not have a share in the next world. It's right after a passage that says everybody gets in. It says all Israel has a share in the next world, and as we talked about a couple weeks ago, yes, non-Jews also, but the focus here is on Jews. And he says, oh, by the way, the following people do not have a share in the next world. Who's your first example? One who says that the resurrection of the dead is not from the Torah. If somebody says that the Torah doesn't believe in it, and also someone who says Torah is not from the heavens, and then it goes on, there are other ways to be drummed out. But the Talmud explains, it's a very simple logic. The person who says, this isn't something we believe in, so God says, okay, then I guess I'll leave you out. If you don't think it's real, then fine, it's not for you. Another piece of evidence that this is standard Jewish belief is in the Amidah. Right, the second blessing of the Amidah speaks of divine might and all the things that God does that are wondrous, and it ends Baruch Ata Hashem Mechaye Hameitim, that God brings the dead to life. So, however you take the biblical text, the rabbis are certain that this is part of Judaism, but the question still is: so, what exactly is it? What is it that is happening? And the answer is, of course, unclear. Three different questions need to be resolved. We're going to look briefly at the uncertainty surrounding each of them. First question is going to be, is this something that occurs during the time of the Messiah, or is it like a separate phase that happens uniquely and after that? Second, when people come back, is it with a body, or is it just the soul coming back to this world? And then third, so when people come back, do they then live forever? Or do they come back, have an existence, and then die? And then go to the Garden of Eden or whatever? Those are three of the many questions that are discussed. So in terms of the first question of when exactly this happens, there's a passage in the Talmud in source number 22, which seems to give an answer. 22 is based on 21. There's a verse in Proverbs that I brought you in number 21, in which the book of Proverbs tells us, when you walk, your parents' lesson will guide you. When you lie down, she will guard you. She, the lesson, will guard you. And when you rise, she will speak with you. In other words, that which you learn from your parents will stay with you always, whether you like it or not. Sorry? Yeah. The passage before it is about Musar Abicha Tirati Mecha, and then it says, "Bidhalecha Tancha Otach B'shoch B'cha Tishmor Alecha Vakitzota Hi Tesichecha." So, "Bidhalecha Tancha Otach," when you walk, "Tancha Otach," it will guide you, right? Lanchot. The B'shoch B'cha, when you lie down, Tishmor Alecha, she will guard you. Vakitzota Lachin, the lesson you learned from your parents. Tarati Mecha and Musar Abicha. And Rakitzota, when you wake up, he tisichecha, right? Sicha, it will be what you speak about. So the Talmud in number 22 says, this is what you learn from that line. When you walk, your parents' lesson will guide you. That's life in this world. When you lie down, she will guard you. That is death. And when you rise, she will speak with you. That's Olam Haba in the future. So in this, there is no, it's death and then come back, and there's no separate messianic period. That's what you're seeing here. However, in number 23, you get, hang on, Diane, you get a midrash on the same verse that breaks it up differently. It starts the same way. When you walk, your parents' lesson will guide you, that's this world. When you lie down, she will guard you, this is death. And when you rise in the time of Mashiach, and she will speak with you in the future. In the future in Hebrew is Olam Haba, the future world, and it seems to indicate that there are actually two separate times. Diane, what was your question? That's in Shema. That's
different. Aren't those the same concepts?
I mean, lying down and rising up, yes. They're the same words.
And walking.
Yeah, it's true. So, what you have here is a lack of clarity of when exactly this is going to happen. The general view, which Maimonides articulates, Maimonides wrote a lot about the resurrection of the dead, because he got in trouble. Well, I don't know if that's why he did it, but he got in trouble. He believed, as we'll see, that the ultimate resurrection is spiritual. It's the soul, not the body. Maimonides' whole system of belief is that you perfect your intellect, you perfect your spirit. And the body is a means towards that, but then once it's gone, you don't need that. And remember that he's part of that philosophical world, which you can see already among the Greeks, that believes in the purity of the spirit and the ideal. And so Maimonides says, yes, there's a resurrection, but it's just the soul's coming back. Which, maybe we're going to talk about that in a moment, but it leads some people to say, well, he doesn't really believe in the resurrection then. And that's bad, because like we said, like if you don't believe in the resurrection, no share in the next world. Is he challenging that? And that leads him to write a special pamphlet on the resurrection, asserting that absolutely it is a real thing, and yes, we believe in it. And he believes that it's a messianic time first, followed by this resurrection of the dead. Is there a hand? Okay. But the bigger question, frankly, that I think people wonder about is less about what the timeline is and more about the physical versus the spiritual. Here, we'll see two passages from the Talmud, both in the name of the sage Rav. So the same sage is the author of both, we are taught. Number 24, Rav regularly said, the next world, what I called the future before, Olam Haba, is not like this one. The next world will not have eating, drinking, procreation, commerce, jealousy, hatred, or competition. Rather, the righteous will sit with crowns on their heads, benefiting from the radiance of the Shekhinah, as it is written, they envisioned God and they ate and drank, and what that means is, at Sinai, the text says, they ate and drank, but there's no food there. It's as he's explaining it, it means the experience of benefiting, being nourished by the presence of God. He says, none of the standard, mundane, earthly things. Rather, it's all spiritual. However, take a look at source number 25, which speaks about the Leviathan, the Leviathan, a very large sea creature mentioned in the book of Job. Rav Yehuda says, citing Rav, God created everything in his world as male and female, including the beam Leviathan and the curved Leviathan, Nachash Beriah and Nachash Akalaton. These are two very big sea creatures, the male and the female. He created them male and female, and were they to mate, they would destroy the entire world. You can imagine if you had all these sea creatures. What did God do? He castrated the male and slaughtered the female. Excuse me, this is male birth control here. The male can't produce, and there is no female. And sold her away for the righteous for the future. Now, there was a physicist, a Jewish physicist, early 20th century, by the name of I.I. Rabi, who was so troubled by this. He said that what led him away from belief in Judaism was when he understood that his grandmother believed that there's this Leviathan that surrounds the earth, and one day God is going to use it to provide a feast for the righteous, and the wicked will have none. He didn't like it. He felt like it was too obviously myth and too obviously simplistic. From my perspective, he didn't read deeply enough. I think that there's a lot going on here in this, way beyond obviously what we're doing at this point, since we're already in the 1 hour mark in a minute. But I bring it here only because it's a statement of a physical resurrection of the dead involving eating, unless you're going to tell me, don't take it literally, which I'm willing to accept. But it sounds like it's saying that indeed it is physical. And in fact, you end up with debate. So if you take a look at source number 26.
Would that not be kosher? That would be kosher.
Apparently it is kosher. Yeah, apparently it is kosher. The
Olivia Dunn,
yes. So if you take a look at number 26, there are bigger problems in that passage. The biblical text prohibits neutering an animal, for starters. So there's a lot more, but I think it's very clear it's not meant as a literal reading. But take a look at source number 26. Rambam, Rabbi Moses Maimonides, writes, Tfiyat HaMetim, the resurrection of the dead, is the foundation of foundations of the Torah of Moshe, our master. There is no religion or connection to the Jewish nation for one who doesn't believe in it. He's really clear. And then he goes on to say, the time of Mashiach is the time when monarchy will return to Israel. They will return to the land of Israel. That monarch's place of reign will be Tzion. His name will be elevated and reach the ends of the earth, greater than the kingdom of Solomon. The nations will make a covenant of peace with him. All of the lands will serve him in his great righteousness. Amazing things will be revealed at his hand. God will destroy and give over to him anyone who rises against him. Maimonides is of the belief that there will be a resurrection. It is separate from the time of the Messiah. If anyone needs to go, I know that I hit the hour mark, and we're going to need an extra few minutes for it. I'm not insulted if anyone needs to go. His belief is that the messianic period is first, and it is physical, and then the resurrection of the dead is something beyond that, and it is spiritual. Nachmanides, coming along right after Maimonides, living in Spain, disagrees, and he says no. He says, in truth, this place, the Garden of Eden, provides actual physical reward in the time of the resurrection. And he quotes you a midrash which says, God will make a feast for the righteous, like what we saw before in the Garden of Eden. And he quotes you a passage in the Talmud which says, God will make a circle for the righteous in the Garden of Eden. He will sit between them and each one will point as if with a finger that you can point to God. This is the future pleasure and reward in the time of the resurrection and the display of the Shekhinah, God's presence. For people will reach the level of our master Moses in that world when the soul ascends over the body to the point that physical energies cease and is clothed always in divine inspiration. And there he moves you into his next phase. He thinks that when we come back with bodies at first, and they need to be nourished, and it's a physical experience, but then the soul, by his exposure to God, becomes more powerful, and at that point, you don't need to eat or drink anymore. At that point, it's like Moses up on Mount Sinai. He's there for 40 days. He doesn't have food. He doesn't have anything to drink. And yet he survives just off of God. And God is able to nourish him without him needing food and drink. So you have a view that says that you have two views, Talmudically, both quoted from the same sage. One saying no eating or drinking, and the other one saying there's this big feast. You can resolve them. You could say the feast one is not literal. That would be a way to resolve them. The truth is, you have debate. Maimonides is of the belief that it is all spiritual. You have, after the messianic time, you have Ramban, Nachmanides, who says no. He says initially there's eating and drinking, and then your soul becomes so powerful that God is nourishing you, but you have a body. Sorry? The big question in all of this is the question I think I just heard, which is, but how do they know this? Where did they get it from? And the answer is, you have biblical verses that speak about coming back. You have biblical verses that speak about some kind of time of reward. And like the verse in Isaiah with the feast, with the beyond, right? So you have some kind of reference. And then after that, they're just working with basically the logic of the system of Judaism overall. So if you have a belief, as Maimonides does, that Judaism is geared towards improving the spirit and the intellect and the mind, then he says, what need is there for a body at all? But on the other hand, Nachmanides is looking at it and saying, but God promised reward and punishment. And if people suffered something in this world and are due a reward, then that's when they're going to get their reward. And that will involve physical pleasure as well as the spiritual, right? Remember, we talked about the goal of living and putting the ethical imperative ahead of the desire for pleasure. Well, at some point, they have to be rewarded for that. And that's what Nachmanides is envisioning happening in that future world. They're applying what they understand about Judaism as a whole to the sparse evidence found in the biblical text. In terms of whether people will die at the end of that period of time, so I will only show you one passage here from the Talmud in source number 28, which thinks that, no, they don't die again. The righteous whom God will resurrect will not return to their dust. The quotes a verse to that effect, that they will indeed remain forever. There is so much more to be said here. I'm giving you just like tip of the iceberg on it. But I want to close with two notes. The number one, why is there this belief in the resurrection of the dead? What is the goal of coming back here? If you have a Garden of Eden, right? Why do people need to come back here at all? And if we had more time, I would do this as a question and answer, but I'm just going to give you my answer, and you could always continue the conversation by email. But I think that the idea here is, and it's demonstrated in the verses that I brought you in 29 to 31, that there's a significance to earth, there's a significance to physical existence within Judaism. God desires there to be a sanctuary, a Beit HaMikdash, a temple, in this world. A place that will be a focus for the relationship between God and us. The resurrection brings people back to this world, emphasizing the importance of that relationship. It recognizes the possibility of a national and individual repentance, the idea that this world can in fact be perfected. Instead of looking at this world as a way station, where we make our mistakes and do what we do and earn reward or earn punishment or whatever it is, this place becomes a place to be perfected and developed, and that is worth returning to. So I think the belief in the resurrection of the dead is also a belief in the validation of the value of our life here in this universe. That it's not just one and done, or even according to the incarnation people, two, three, four times and done, but it's actually a destination. And I think that's a really important point to keep in mind as you look at this.
So we've been here before.
I didn't say that. And then number 32, the last source that I want to read out, you can do the review questions yourself, is a source that we saw back in week two, and I think is so important, which is keep the eye on the ball. Right? Remember what the focus is. Rabbi Chaim of Elazar is quoted by his son. His son says that his father would rebuke him when he saw he didn't participate in the pain of others. And his message was, one is not created for himself, but only to benefit others to the full extent of his powers. And ultimately, that's the goal of our existence here. There is much, much more to say, as always. Thank you so much for participating in the series.